The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
And joining me on the podcast right now, and don't forget the videos up there as well. You can check out my shirt, which is quite normal this week. But Paul's here. He makes up for all the colour, all the vibrancy you need in the markets. Paul Hill, equity analyst, full-time investor. How are you feeling in the markets, Paul, at the moment?
I think like everybody else, I'm pretty battered. A bit like you, it's been sort of one-way traffic. But I've got a big question for you now, Justin. I know you've got to see your plain shirt on and you're feeling a bit bruised as well. But has the market sort of started to bottom now? Because we've got a green day today, yes. And I mean just a one sort of hit wonder and it may go, etc. But we are starting to see inflation top out now, certainly on goods, on labour to a certain extent, because a lot of the big tech boys are shedding staff. Freight rates have come down. Amazon has got surplus warehousing capacity. It's trying to, I mean, it's got 40 million square feet in the States to sell out. So what we're starting to see is inflation, some green shoots there, that it's not going up. Oil's also obviously come off a bit, you know, which is great. Mm-hmm. And on that basis, the yield curve in the States has actually dropped by 40 basis points across the whole of the duration over the last couple of weeks. And I was just looking at the top level at one of these break-even inflation rates, the 10-year out in the States. And at the start of the year, in January, the 1st, it was about 2.55%. On average, they were expecting CPI to be over 10 years. It reached a peak in April, as everybody, you know, suspected, of 3%. Yeah, it's now dropped back to lower than when it was on the 1st of January. It's 2.5%. So roughly around, just slightly less than where it was 6 months ago. So big question to you, and you're our markets expert at all things technical and also macro related. Are we starting to see a bit of a sort of bottoming process for the market?
Yeah, do you know what? That's it. That's the word, process, and that's it. Because people think a bottom just gets hit and then we bounce. It doesn't. And I've been looking back at some stats, indices, and in fact, 2 days ago, AIM hit its recent low, and that's from the high on the 6th of September.
It's 31% down, isn't it?
Yeah, the AIM 100 is down 36%. Nine months we've been into this now. But just looking at some of the stats here, they are quite worrying. And part of me thinks, why is the market so low so quickly? Because the S&P, right, for example, 500, pretty much everything follows that, tracks that a little bit. But it's down 23%, right, in the first 116 trading days of 2022. That's the second worst performance in history. And the worst, only worse than that, was 1932, the Great Depression. Then why is this sell-off so hard? Is it just the markets are reacting faster these days? Is it just more quant trading? Let's bring it all down. What is it? And you look through all these stats, you think, this is quite worrying, because if you look at it, there's only been 8 years. Now, it's an amazing stat. It's only been 8 years where the S&P has experienced 15 days or more in 1 year, that is, where the indices have been down more than 3%. That's since 1928. And this is 1930 was 16 days, where it moved 3% down. The worst is 1932, 50% down in 1 day. But these are historical times we're talking about here. And it gets me thinking, what's the issue? Because we're all know
okay. Let's break that one down. What is the issue? How much is fundamentals? Because the fundamentals have brought, effectively has pushed US interest rates up. Yeah, expectations. We all know that from the start of the year. We've seen it from the 10-year going up from 2% now to roughly round about just about 3%. So it's up. So what we've seen is your discount rate for your long duration assets. That's a fundamentals. It's made those type of assets, you know, sort of like brought the price down for those. That's a fundamental. Inflation expectations have obviously, well, they're about sort of flat. So, but you have got, and people are obviously building in a recession. So there are, when you come to answer your question, how much is sort of like, what's it due to? Well, some of it's fundamentals, but how much, and this is the question to you, how much is technical and just sentiment and people getting overly bearish?
Yeah, but I know, but people have always get overly bearish, but even on those levels, this is quite a big drawdown, you know, quickly. And but and also to talk about recession, it's very important to look at that, because a sell-off or bear market, the duration of that is obviously worse than a recession. And if you look at them, there's a guy on Twitter worth looking at called Charlie Bilalio, I think he is, but he does all the stats on the S&P, very good, very in-depth. And he said, basically, going back to 1928, if you look at recessions and bear markets, the S&P, the average for a bear market is about 12 months. With a recession, it's 16 months. So it's a big difference there. And so, you know, we're currently only 5 months into the S&P rollover, you know, from the recent highs. So even if it's 12 months, we've got a way to go yet. So I'm saying, I don't think we, if the bottoming process is happening, I think we've got a bit further to go. So just
we're 9 months. We're 9 months into this, into AIM.
Yes,
for
9 months into AIM.
For small caps, we've only got another 3 months left.
But you know what? I revisited those figures, and this is a bit gutting, really, because I revisited those figures from the Great Financial Crash. And even though we say, oh, the microcaps are bottom fast and come out faster, essentially they did hit their lows, you know, before the rest of the indices, but they just bumbled along the bottom there. And pretty much, I mean, the low dates are all within a month of each other, from the S&P, FTSE 100. They're all within a month of each other.
My portfolio definitely started to increase way before the FTSE bottomed on March 29, 2009.
Your portfolio may, but the stats are here, right? FTSE, right? It bottomed on the 28th of the 2nd, 2009, okay? Now, the earliest to bottom was, so AIM, for example, again, same day, AIM all share, but November, the AIM 50 and the AIM 100 bottomed in November. But if you look at the chart, it bottomed and went basically flat until January, February time, when it started to rally again with everything else. So it may find that bottom earlier and may go sideways for a while, but it doesn't rally. It didn't rally last time anyway, you know? So I'm just thinking, we have to be prepared here. This, if a recession is happening, it's not going to be easy for a while. And even though we are 9 months in, you say, well, if the average is like 12 months or 16 months, whatever, it's a while off. So I don't know.
I mean, I think I'm not quite as negative on that. And the reason why I would overlay is that is you're taking a sort of like a purely passive indexed, okay?
Yeah, absolutely.
Now you and I, you overlay your stock picking, your alpha on top of it, and what happens is that good stocks and bad stocks in a sort of like a downbeat market get sold off. It's all that classic boats fall as the tide goes out at the same time. Doesn't matter, it's good or bad, babies get thrown out with the bathwater, but the babies start rising faster than the rest of the bathwater as we move out, as we start this bottoming. So for people like you, and hopefully me as well, our portfolios, because we've got more babies in there than the general bathwater, then we should start seeing some positive movement on our stock holdings. And to be frank,
I've said for the last couple of weeks, couple of months maybe,
that some of my stocks have had profit warnings, and they've really gone down a great deal. For instance, I mean, it's actually back now, Aviva, after a profit warning, to almost the price that I bought it at, which is frankly shows the quality of the company. And that's what I come down to. It's your stock picking prowess, plus your marketing, plus your market's understanding. That combination should mean that you'll see a better portfolio performance than the rest of the bathwater, which is still a bit dirty and muddy
I agree with you. You know, I got to preface this, those were indices. And like I said, stock picking is where it's at. So it's a market of stocks, absolutely. But I keep thinking, I don't know whether you think this, but I keep thinking until we see inflation not getting worse. And I envy it, the printout recently from, you know, April to the year to April, 9%, and now to May, 9.1%. The rise doesn't seem as big as if you look at previous months, which we think, okay, we may be seeing a peak here. That's what the market needs, because at the moment, like, central banks are fighting an unknown quantity. When will it peak? If they can get an angle on it, a size of this, say, okay, we know it's going to peak. But of course, what we got in the UK is this energy cap, which is going to go up in October. So we may have a little dip before then. And they've got the energy cap, which is the biggest input to inflation. I think it's 2.9%. And the second biggest is food, which is 1.5%. So it's almost double that. If that comes down, it may blip back up. And that's what's happened in the 70s, for example. I know it's a lot different from the 70s, a loss of induced inflation recession. The 70s had three bear markets. So it came out, went back in, came out really volatile sort of decade, the 70s, wasn't it? So
All I would say is that most sensible investors are going to look through that, okay? Mm. At these artificial blockages in the system will, like effectively your energy cap will move, and they're just temporary measures that sort of stop and start potential inflation. The canny investor looks through all of that and looking at what the inputs are to it. Yeah,
yeah. I think all I would say is
that actually look at the big picture. US 10-year break-even inflation rates are about the same as they were 6 months ago.
Yeah. No, listen. It's like I said, hard to call any bottom in a recession. All you can go on is what you see in the markets. And like I said,
should rephrase that.
All you can look at is previous stats, pretty much. Even just the average duration, right? And these are like 23 bear markets since 1928. You know, so that's a good average you can get from that, you know. And so, if you're looking at that, you know, it's maybe different this time. Who knows? But just looking at the average stats, and there's a lot of stats to go by, then we're not towards the end here. But who knows? Like I said, if we get that, if inflation is steering this and we get figures that aren't any worse, that'll be good. And I think the markets will rally. And like you say, even a blip here or there may pull the market back a little bit.
Let's be clear about it. I mean, the market and you and me are expecting inflation to already get worse, okay? Mm. The Bank of England said it's going to get worse. It's going to get to 11%. Yeah. So,
do we trust
nobody,
them?
It isn't going to scare anybody when it hits 11%, right? What it would scare is if it started in 12 or 13% or hits 11%, not because of the energy price cap come rolling off, but because of other reasons which we haven't baked in. And what the key bit is looking at the delta. What is going to change going forward? And my instinct is, some goods prices are starting to go off. You know, obviously there's some of the clothes retailers, the homeware retailers, and stuff like that. They've basically overstocked and there's surplus to shift. Yeah, so that's starting to come off. Let's see where oil is, in terms of over the next few months, if that starts rolling off. And likewise, you know, freight rates have definitely come down. Warehousing is starting to free up as well. And the labour market is definitely in the tech side. The pricing is coming off as well. So
yeah.
It is what the delta is, and what the market isn't expecting is going to be the key to drive drive interest rates effectively.
Well, do you think that's why the Bank of England, forecasting is very hard, very few people get it right. Do you think that's why they're saying 11%? Because they're hoping it won't go above that, and if it comes under that, then it's better.
No, they're saying it because of you, effectively not what following you're doing, but they're basically saying, you know, when the energy price cap comes off, because it's a big weighting, it's going to push up utility bills, and therefore, just by doing the maths, it's going to 11% from 9.1% this morning. I mean, you know, from this week. So, you know, I mean, it's not rocket science. It's just the way the maths works when you calculate CPI. And let's be clear about it. RPI is already over 11.5%. I think it was 11.7%, you know, when it came out in May, when you put in shelter and stuff like that. So, and food prices are rising also. I just think we're reaching a bottoming. I mean, I don't know. I mean,
you're right. Because if you look at the commodity prices, they're all sort of rolling over. Just looking at wheat today, that's really rolled over. Natural gas futures really rolled over.
Iron ore, copper.
Yeah, copper, exactly. I mean, I chart alerts on copper. It's one of those alerts I set way back on a technical level on the chart, and it just popped up, and I thought, what the heck is that? And, of course, it's called Dr. Copper because it's good at predicting. But here's a stat that's quite good, actually, and quite positive. And if you look at the long term on this, you realise. So if you look at the average sort of, you know, bear market, pretty much, they'd last. Bear markets last, say, 14 months, drops of 36%. We're not far off that. AIM 100 is there. You know, but bull markets, compared to sort of 14 months, last for 40 months, rise by 133%. That's without a drop of 20%. So just timing the market, you realize you're playing on the right side if you're a bull, you know, and that's the way forward. So, yeah, you know, 36% drop versus a 130% rise in the longer term. So, I mean, it's going to happen. We all know bear markets end, and we're all obsessed with the uncertainty of when it's going to end, and that's it, the uncertainty. But we know it will, and some of the best rallies are from the bottomish levels. So that's why trying to, like people say, trying to time the market is no good, because those big up days, if you miss out on a couple of those, it'll affect your portfolio return, you know? So, yeah, absolutely.
So let's come full circle then. So we both got the same view, yeah, in terms of, you know, there's better times ahead, no doubt about it. So look, let's try and look at some babies here. And I know you've had a look at the sort of the housing market. You've talked about on the market, and also Taylor Wimpey you've had a look at just recently. Take us through the sort of where you think the housing market and those. Because, I mean I used to own Taylor Wimpey, and I cannot believe it's below 120p.
Exactly.
Net asset value is 135.
Exactly. I mean, everyone's sort of bearish now. We're thinking the last thing the rollover will be, you know, the housing market and stuff like that. But if you look at the chart, Taylor Wimpey, let's get the chart up here. You think, how much is this priced in? And they've got a dividend.
Your net tangible assets, last time I looked, was about 135. It's got a ton of cash and it's buying back shares. Yes, there's still a bit of an overhang from the cladding thing. But frankly, none of the house builders are saying the house prices are rolling over. In fact, if anything, they're saying, you know, at sort of like high single digits, 10% per annum, they're more than compensating for the elevated input costs they're suffering.
Yeah, and I know last year was a bit of a boom, but you think, this is a big company. They did like 54% top-line growth last year, you know, from $2.7 billion to $4.2. They got net cash of 830-odd million. They got dividend cover above 2. They're paying about 7% because their share price has come off so much in yield. And you're thinking, okay, so maybe it's not a bottom, but if I start scaling in here, how long is it going to last for? It's come off like, 20, 30%? Yeah, exactly. So I think something like that. If you look at dividends, I mean, John Heumann, of course, ex-editor of Investor Chronicle, and I do this weekly screener, he screens for stocks. This week he did dividends, and these were high-quality dividend payers who have their dividend cover above, I think, 1.5. Taylor Wimpey's above 2, I think, a 7.7% yield. And I was thinking, okay, well, if you want a bit of income, you know, you could just scale into this over the next year or so or whatever, or take your time, you know, because that's a quality company. And there may be a bit of rough waters ahead fundamentally, but isn't that priced in a little bit, you know? So,
about on the market? Because they came out with some news. Did you interview the guy, Jason?
Yes,
and,
I did.
Clive?
And it's all heading in the right direction. And the thing for them, the problem with on the market is that, of course, they get their the good thing is, if you look at the figures they have on the market, like Rightmove, what is that? Is it, it's a 5-6 billion market cap company. They're not far off. They pretty much, you know, on the market have the same amount of, I think it's 15,000 compared to like 13,000 from the market, but 15,000 agents at Rightmove. So they're not far off from them. But the thing is, they only charge 188 quid pretty much to these subscribers, whereas I think Rightmove charge in excess around about £900,000 a month. Now, if you're getting the exact kind of, the stats are going up, everything's going in the right direction, all they need to do is convert some of the people they have now on trials or, you know, low-paying fees, and that will significantly improve, you know, on the market. I think, what's on the market's market cap at the moment? So they're profitable, they're growing pretty much, and so their market cap is ridiculous compared to where they are. So I think, and of course, the problem is supply. There's not enough stock coming onto the property market. If you see interest rates go up, you may see people downsizing, you may see people, you know, selling because they're stretched a little bit. That'll help supply, you know, that'll help sales. Because there's always people out there with cash who don't need mortgages or don't need a big mortgage, don't affect them too much. So I think, if anything, that'll help them, you know, a little bit of churn in the market. That'll help them a lot. So, but yet these kind of portals are getting sold off. But you understand, they need supply. That's exactly what they need. They need deals to go through. So the more deals that happen, so you know, there's always demand, isn't there, in the UK for housing?
Yeah, I mean, I saw both the last trading update from Taylor Wimpey and the one I read, the sort of headlines on the market. They neither of them are saying the housing market is rolling over. They're both, in fact. Well, from the coal face in the field, from buyers and sellers. I mean, admittedly, the housing market is a lagging indicator, but even so, when you have nobody who's a key operator within that industry saying it's slowing off, then you've got to say, well, you know, residential property, you know, it's doing okay at the moment. It's but the share prices are just on the floor, and on that basis, you've got a lot of bad news priced in. And you know, when I spoke to Christopher Mills of Harwood Capital, which was about 6 months ago, he was buying on the market hand over fist at about £1, and now it's what, 85p. You know, that basis.
Yeah, and just be honest, like I said, there's always pent up demand in the housing market. The house prices very rarely go down, and so you could say stagnation in house prices is probably the dip. You know, that people will buy. That's all they need. Or it's not growing as fast, because we know over time it'll be fine. You know, you know what? Over the road from me, a guy sold a house, our neighbour, and he put the price on there, and we thought, oh, that's quite a punchy price. Because, he had 8 people here on that Saturday. There was a bidding war, and he got 10% over ask. And they're still arguing over the price. It still may go up. So it's still very buoyant, the market, you know. And I think that's not going to stop just because, a couple of percentage points on the mortgage rates here. Because it's always demand. People want a house, don't they? That's it. So, but I think the markets will rally. I think and the housing market will soften a little bit, but it's not bad for the portals. And then I think after that, the housing market will pick back up again. So, if you want to buy a house and you're an investor in stocks, it's a good time, I think. Stock market rally first, take a bit of profit, then buy a house when the house prices, you get good deals because plenty of supply about, and then it'll rise again then. So, pretty much. Mm.
But I mean, other ones, other babies that have been thrown out. I mean, you know, we've talked about it, and I know you. I think you quite like this whole space. Is Saieta, which does sort of like next generation electric motors, their AFT, and they came out with an operational update last week or a couple of weeks ago. And I think you're actually going to do a podcast with them fairly soon, with a bit of luck. But anyway, I mean, these guys, they're seeing unprecedented demand. And what they're actually doing is that rather than just offering a sort of like a AFT or an axial flux electric motor, they're doing the whole sort of like driveline, the whole technology subsystems. And that why that is important is because they're end OEMs, your likes of, you know, sort of like your competition to Tesla and these kind of guys, then it allows them to jumpstart their particular vehicles, because rather than having to deal with hundreds of flipping suppliers, if they can buy one system that's seamless, fully integrated, and they can just take it and put it in, then it saves them a lot of time, a lot of testing, a lot of R&D, product approval, and this sort of stuff. And so what Saieta are doing is combining their AFT or their axial flux electric motor with the whole drive line, with the gears, the powertrain, all that kind of stuff, and then putting it into one system so they can sell that on. And that'll really sort of jumpstart their growth. And they can make all of these out in Sunderland in their new facility that they've rent. So, you know, that's great. And they're also seeing tremendous demand for their, you know, their Propel outboard motor electric electric motor, alongside the ones for the sort of like, you know, the utility vehicles, the sort of vans and stuff like that, which I think it was the AF140, I think it is. It's one something like that anyway. But their shares have come down, you know. About, last time I saw, they're about 150 or maybe even sort of slightly less than that.
Well, do you know what? There's a company I looked at, and it's literally, obviously, during the last bit of the bull market there, or I don't know if we're out of the bull market or whatever, but, it came to the market, and I liked it. I thought this, and when I'm looking at stocks, one of the filters I look at is, does the company have, you know, huge tailwinds, and you've got to look at, you know, companies like that in any aspect, I think, and thinking, is this market just going to get bigger and bigger over the next decade? And of course, this is, you know, regulatory drivers, everything, and this is not going to get smaller. The end markets are growing, and they're going to continue to grow for decades. And so, but it shot up like crazy. I look at the chart on the 13th of August, we're up 32%. And all this is based on future potential, of course, and what's to come. And they went to 280 from what was the IPO? So we're at 130 or something. So we're at
something like that.
Peaked out at 3
quid. But you look at the sales structure. I mean, when you talk about sort of like growth, Last year, they did around about 4 million of sales. Yeah. They're predicted to do this year 21 million pounds of sales. And then, the following year, 63. And they could blow past that anyway, because they could do that with a few big OEM orders. I mean, it's ramping up production. That's what it is.
Yeah, but if you look at the chart, when people see that and see they've got an excellent product in a very hot market, it's going to be hot for a long time, and you're in a good buoyant market, liquid market, it rises like crazy, you know? And now all that potential and hype has come out of it. It's back pretty much close to IPO level. And I said, bear market's an excellent time to do research, because now you say, You know, nothing's going to rise very quickly, very soon. You've got time to actually scale into this, do some research if you want to, and just follow the updates of the company. You know it's in a big market. It's going to grow. It's going to do very well. But it's back to where all that sort of hot air, hype liquidity has come out of it a little bit. And now it's back to levels where you think, okay, now this is where I like it at. You know, so, yeah. And you know, they're doing all the right things, and they're in good markets.
Well, they've got great shareholders as well. Yeah. I mean, they've got Andy Brough from Schroders, Gervais Williams of Premier Might, and there's another guy I interviewed who talked about it, Oliver Brown of RC Brown. And also they've got the boys from the old Hargreave Hale from Canaccord, Guy Feld and Eustace Santa Barbara. So all of them are really well-respected fund managers who are back in this management team. And actually, everyone's all independently said the CEO, Vic Kist, is absolutely fabulous, real entrepreneur, and he's doing really good. I mean, he's doing organic growth, really good, but also a lot of sort of, you know, M&A stuff. He bought that one out of Evergrande, you know, the Chinese e-traction. And he's likewise, you know, he's done the Sunderland facility as well. So he's a really, really good and, you know, neat operator that he's really sort of got a fantastic runway ahead for it. So, yeah. I mean, I think he ticks all of the right boxes. It's great market, excellent technology, you know, access to capital because of the shareholders, and the management team's fab. So what's not to like?
Do you know what? Oddly, it did in March. It sort of hit this level and bounced, went from 135 back up to £2. It's come back to this level now. And it's what's nice is it seems to be forming that sort of bottom process. Mm. So it may, you know, go a little bit lower. Who knows in this market?
Hey, bottom process. You're using that word again, aren't you? It's bottom it.
It's always, you've always got to use the bottom process.
you need to wash your mouth out, boy.
Yeah, who knows? Well, it's just my mouth. Yeah.
It's
on the watch list for me. It's on the watch list for me. I mean, like I said, but
hey, I'll tell you another one. Another one which is flipping on the watch list that my daughter's actually owned some shares in it, but I haven't got any spare cash, but I would be buying. And I did see a very astute life sciences investor who I am speaking to on Monday, Mr. Christopher Mills of Harwood Capital, topped up his stakes. So this company I'm talking about is Verici, which makes next generation sort of immunodiagnostics for kidney transplant patients and operations, both pre and post sort of graft operation. Now, it came out with initial results about 2 months ago for its post-operative test, Tutiva, saying that it was the results were significantly better than the competition. Anyway, it released at this American Transplant Conference a couple of weeks ago the actual detail for it, and it said it had a sort of like predictive value or positive predictive value of around about 60%, I think, a negative predictive value of about 80%. And the market just got it wrong. The shares went down. And this is just like, you know, great news. And this is another case of, you know, the baby being thrown out. And obviously Chris Mills realized that the market's got it wrong. And so you look at it and you just say, okay, what did the market get wrong? Well, what it did, you had a couple of people on the sort of the blogging community who looked at the negative predictive value of the test and compared it to another operator that has a similar sort of level of about 80 or slightly higher of 80% and said, crikey, the test isn't as good as something which is already out there. They've got it totally wrong. And the reason is, okay, the reason is because actually when you're a doctor, you've got you concentrate on what the PPV is, your positive predictive value. And I'll just give you an example, right? I'm going to say you've got a lovely shirt there, okay? And I'm going to pretend you are not Dr. Copper, but Dr. Waite, okay? Who's an expert in all things kidney transplant, right? Mm. Now I'm in the I'm a guy who's going to have a oh my god, I don't know why I am, but I'm going to have a transplant that you're going to do, okay? So I'm going to have my kidney take it. I'm going to have a new kidney put in, right? Now you're the doctor, and you say, "Crikey, Paul, I've got this kidney. Yeah, I need to make sure that you're not going to sort of like, you know, reject it. Yeah. So I'll do the operation, but the therapy and the treatments that you're going to be having your immunosuppressants will depend on how you accept it and whether you reject it. Okay. So you do the actual operation. It gets put into my body, and you're a bit concerned, etc., how it's actually being accepted within me. Okay. So you can actually make some tweaks. You can change it, etc. Now, if you look at basically just the negative predictive value, that says to me, you do a test and it says, is Paul okay? Is there any problem? And that says, it says basically on existing test and for Verici's test, no, there's no problem. Okay, well, that's great. Okay, it's useful information, but you're not going to do anything, okay? What you really want to know is it causing an issue, yeah? Mm. And so effectively, Verici's test tells you in real world conditions across all different patient types that actually, yes, there is damage occurring, yeah? The other competitor test is a multiple lower and, you know, considerably, substantially less accurate in telling you whether, yes, there's actual damage. So the analogy I would say, you being a doctor, yeah, is because the difference is that Verici's test uses your immune system, which is really the key attacking agent, the key vector that damages the kidney, whereas existing tests just use effectively they monitor whether the damage has actually occurred in the blood. You can see debris from the actual kidney in that particular blood. So the analogy is, yeah, and this is my analogy as much as anything, is that if you're a doctor and you're treating me, and I've just had one, you have a kidney you just put in, yeah. This Verici test gives you a radar to assess whether there's incoming missiles doing damage to my kidney, and therefore you can actually try and stop or alert these missiles and put protective measures. You can change my drug regime, my immunosuppressants, or give me other treatments that are going to help me, you know, accept that particular. So whilst the actual attack is occurring, you can adjust my treatments, right? Mm-hmm. Now, so that's the Verici test. Then the existing test on the market, if you do that instead, won't tell you about when the damage is occurring. Well, sorry, when in real time when the damage is occurring, it'll only tell you when actually the missiles hit my kidney, blown it up, and there's bits and pieces everywhere in my body that you can pick it up. So that's why it's so important to have this positive predictive value. Verici's test is real time, gives future information, actionable information to a doctor like you who can change my treatment regime to make sure that I accept it. And this is absolutely key because there's so few, you know, sort of like donor parts around. There's 300,000 people on the waiting list, you know, hoping to get a transplant, even far more, you know, people even, you know, not been able on dialysis machines, not even able to get on a waiting list. There's only 100,000 effectively organs available, which is suitable. So there's 100,000 operations worldwide. And the rejection rate over time can be 40-50%. Yes. And this damage...
It's essential, they match the right donor and it continues to work, potentially.
And, yeah. And this damage occurs over quite some time, months and years, etc. So and if you're my doctor, you want to know when the damage is occurring straight away. As in, like, you know, early doors, so you can do some. It's like having cancer. The Verici test will be able to say stage one cancer, early cancer. We can do something about it. We can treat this guy. Yeah. The existing test on the market, which you compare it to, will only tell you metastatic stage four. Once the damage has occurred, and there's nothing you can do when you're going to have to basically replace the transplant. And he's going back onto the dialysis machine. So that is why it's absolutely crucial. Anyway, the market got it wrong, you know, and I think
Chris Mills has taken advantage of that.
Yeah, well, I just think the shares are just ridiculous. They're just ridiculously priced. But, that really is a.
I'm just looking at that. The difference between private investors and institutional investors tend to make a lot more money than private investors. But private investors will look at their portfolio, see a share price is going down, and pretty much emotionally sell it, regardless of what's going on behind the company. A smart institutional investor will see, they won't look at their portfolio, they look at the value of the company they're investing in, thinking, wow, that's now even cheaper. I'm going to buy some more of that. And that's the difference, you know? Private investors are larger because they're owning money and more emotional, of course, more attached to that. And when they see paper losses, they'll just jump out sometimes. You think, well, hang on a sec, you're not thinking about the business, you just look at the share price, you know?
Mm. Well, what I'm saying is that this was good news which came out, but the market fixated on the wrong flipping measure, fixated on the negative predictive value, the rule-out test, rather than actually the rule-in test, which is the positive predicted value, which is what the healthcare community and doctors are paying for the test. They're not basically that interested in the negative. It doesn't tell them anything actionable they can do, other than actually the patient is not actually having any damage, you know, doesn't seem to be. What he wants to know is those 40 to 50% of the times when there's a major issue. And what's really key, what's really key is that you might do the test on me after 6 months to see, you know, how I'm accepting it, etc. Right? And then it comes back and says you're fine. Then you might also want to do the test a year, 2 years later, to see whether my immune system is now causing me damage, And this one does it in effectively longitudinal. It'll tell you not only whether your immune system is damaging, it's the radar, what is damaging your after 6 months. It'll tell you after a year or 2 years as well. And that's why your positive predictive value is just so great. It's what you need. And this thing will carry on. These tests will continue to get better and better because they've got that biobank of knowledge where they'll start getting more information, adding to it, mining the data and improving the diagnostics. So their lead against competing products will continue to increase. And anyway, they're bang on track in terms of commercializing it, the actual product. They've got their pre-operation test. Clarava, their results is coming out in the next, probably the next couple of months, next few weeks. And after that, I'm hoping to actually speak to a US physician who's a kidney transplant guy, expert. And I'm actually going to try and, ask him essentially what's his view on the coalface, how much better, is this going to help him when it comes to, for him to do his transplant? So anyway, the point is such that, baby in the bathwater. The market got it wrong. It took the wrong end of the stick, and smart investors have taken a view. The shares, frankly, are just silly value.
Yeah, sub 28 million, 29 million market cap.
I mean, my daughter's had some spare cash, and so they've bought some on the market, which is fab.
Yeah,
admittedly, it's a slightly higher price, but who cares? You know, they hold for a long period, and
exactly.
I just wish I had some spare cash because I'd be piling in as well.
Hey, let me ask you. I know one of your stocks, Boohoo and all that, the Assos, because a lot of people hold these stocks, you know, darlings of the stock market, taking a bit of a hammer in. Assos come out, didn't they, with some figures.
Zalando as well, so this morning came out with a negative, which is the big European competitor. And their shares are off another bat. They had a bath today of about, 15, 20%, I understand.
It's phenomenal, isn't it? I know inflation's, and in fact, shipping costs and all that are coming down now. But I know these kind of companies are going to take a hit with inflation. Of course, that's priced in pretty much. But if you go back like 2, 3 years, 4 years, people would be pulling their arms off to buy these kind of companies at these levels, wouldn't they? You know, and now people are standing back thinking, "Oh." So, what's your thoughts on Boo? Because it's come off a lot, hasn't it? You know.
Well, they came out with a trading update and they reiterated guidance. Yeah, and the CEO, some people on the media and in the actual, particularly on the bulletin boards, sort of say he should go. But I've spoken to him a couple of times and I think he's great. He's doing a terrific job. He's doing the right strategy. He's putting in a new warehouse distribution system, which would come on stream in the US. He's automating the existing facilities, I think with the one in Sheffield. So, putting in also the robotics into the warehouses. So he's reducing costs. And once he gets distribution out in the States, then that, you know, actual local distribution, that means their fulfillment. Because, I mean, they've got very good demand in the States. They're, unfortunately, with all the freight rates and the times to get the, for the planes to get over there at the moment because of the pandemic, it's meant that they can't deliver it on the, you know, next day or the next 2 days. And it's just is not good enough for sort of like, you know, that this type of competitor. You need local distribution. So push it 12 months, that all should all be in place. And on that basis, then there's no reason why the US shouldn't be then growing really well along the same lines as the UK. And if you put those two together, you know, you'll have a fabulous business that will be back to sort of like, you know, EBITDA margins of 8 or 9%, perhaps even higher. And you'll have strong double-digit growth. And they've got capacity to do 4 billion of sales, and they're currently on about 2 billion. So you can easily see over the next 5 years how this, you know, sort of like just as a commercial operation could double its size. And then you get that operating leverage coming through. So I think the strategy's right. Come, obviously, execution's going to come down to it. And again, they're doing a lot of self-help because when it comes to sort of what's hit the whole industry and them, they got sight of it first, is this level of much higher returns as people have sort of like, you know, gone back to work and changed and all this sort of stuff. Well, what the industry's doing is now it's actually going to start putting, you know, fees in if you start returning goods. And the reason why that is, you know, you think about it. Well, one, you get people who are effectively abusing the whole damn system. They're ordering different size. They know they're not going to need, and they just like send the stuff back. But once you, if you actually think about it, if you start overlaying AI or even AR technology, augmented reality technology, very good that can help consumers from their screen size particular products properly, and you see that on the screen how it fits and all this sort of stuff, then you give the consumer much better confidence that actually they're never going to need to, you're not going to return these at all because, you know, the fit is going to be great. And on that basis, the technology should, in theory, get better and better, remove this much higher level of returns levels from the whole of the industry. So again, I think that's solvable as well.
And so when also, it comes people down, are, you know, repeat offenders like that, surely they have the power to ban those kind of people who are just literally, you know, having stuff, wearing it out and taking it back.
They're not stupid though, these guys who the repeat offenders, because they just hop from one different site to the next, you know, and just keep doing the same thing, you know, buying maybe eBay, Amazon, Zalando, ASOS. They just go between the whole bunch of them, call themselves different names. It's quite difficult to actually pick them up. But the industry's Zara is already put in returns prices. You've had the whole industry pushing up prices for starters, because you've got Next pushing up prices, and you've got a lot of physical stores doing it as well. So you're seeing that, but you are also, you know, seeing a sort of like, or you know, the whole industry is experiencing some demand, you know, destruction in certain product lines. Coming back to the original question, what do I think of Boohoo? I think, again, it's silly prices at current levels. It's about 60p. And I could see if they hit their right strategy, it'll be well over £3. Well, £3, £4, £5 in about 4 or 5 years. And so, yeah, I mean, I've lost a lot of money, but there's no way I'm selling at these levels because
you
just
haven't lost a lot, have you? You just that's the thing, don't you? You haven't lost a lot yet. You still got the same amount of shares. You know, I mean, the portfolio value's gone down a little bit. That's what I mean. But it's fine.
I've lost. If you look at it in paper terms, I've lost a few hundred thousand on it. Okay.
I try to reframe this with my wife a couple of times, and in fact, myself, she said a couple of times, she owns shares. I said, I want to sell my shares. You know, we're at the bottom of the market. I said, why do you want to sell your shares? I'm losing money. I said, you're not losing any money. You've still got the same amount of shares. You know, share price has gone down. It's a bear market. You've got to expect that. I said, you know, why are you thinking of selling in the worst time in a bear market? The best time to sell is in a bull market. And I did say on Twitter, I said, stop checking your share prices and look at the sale prices of your shares in a bear market. It's no good. If you don't need the money right now, if you're not desperate for it, ignore your portfolio. Check the share prices in a bull market. That's the best time to check them if you want to sell them. Unless you want to sell them, don't keep checking them, because emotionally it's painful and you'll make some impulsive decision to sell and you realize in a year's time, I made a mistake there. It's just, you know. Having said that about consumer confidence, I don't know if you saw that consumer confidence thing come out. It's sunk to a new record low this month. And the market research firm, which is, it's down at minus 41.
Here's Justin.
I know. Minus 41, right? Levels like that before preceding recession. So that's it's a record. And I think we're talking ourselves into a recession here. It's like everything you see on TV, doom and gloom about everything. And people started sort of behaviorally tighten their belts, which makes it worse. I think act normally. Don't go overspending, of course, but it's just making everyone scared to spend. I think you've got to worry about that, because that is not helping the situation at all.
What's the score on your consumer stocks? Obviously, you've got
XPF has taken a hit. You know, it's gone. I mean, it hit a high of 48 pence. It's down to 20 pence. This is like now they're predicting we're halfway through the year, pretty much. You know, and they're going to come out. They're forecast to do sales of like 24 million. They've got an EV of 22 million now, which is like less than one time sales. They've got cash of 8 million, and they're profitable this year, and they're growing by an amazing rate. And I'm just thinking, calm down, everyone. I think people still go out for the treats. You know, people are not going to lock themselves away in a house. You know, we're not talking about people. We're not talking about this business. Doesn't need people to be spending crazily for it to do well. They just need people to go out and have the odd treat here and there. That's still going to happen. I think everything's priced in here. Every doom and gloom merchant is out there saying everyone's going to stop spending. It doesn't. People still go to birthday parties, enjoy things. It's fine. And I think, again, I don't know when the time will be, but we'll look back on this in a year's time and I wish I'd taken a bit of advantage of that, because valuation-wise, like I said, they're growing hugely, one of the fastest now experiential leisure companies in the company. They've said the return on capital is exceeding their box economics where they launched. It's all going very well, and so I think it's cheap. All I can do is just sit and wait. There's no point.
What about your space and people? I did notice one of the big shareholders sold out, which was Rockwell Strategic, which is the old Gresham Strategic, and that I know the fund manager there. He's a really smart cookie.
When was that? It was a while back, wasn't it?
Yeah. He sold out a while back. That's basically Richard Staveley.
Yeah. You know, it's sort of a while back. That's why when that tanked the price, that's why I got in. So
Yeah,
the price dropped by 25% in one day, so that's why I sort of got in.
What price did you get in?
Where are we now? In fact, it's probably back to where it is now because of that, because of the sell-off. And I did ask, actually, Nancy, CEO, I said, how are things going? I've noticed they're doing a lot. If you look at their social media platforms, there's a lot of activity going on in shopping centres and all that. So they seem very, very busy. But, of course, I don't know much about the figures at the moment, but they seem very busy. I did say, what about the train strikes? And she said, no problem at the moment because people pre-book anyway in advance bookings. I mean, if it carries on for a long term, of course, we have to redirect maybe some of the customers elsewhere to shopping centres. But, I mean, at the moment, it's not a problem. So, but, yeah, I just think, where are we? We're going to do about 6 million of revenue there. It'd be pretty much break-even or profitable. They are 2.5 million market cap. But again, sentiment is hitting these stocks like crazy. And so I'm just going to wait to they report some figures and see what's happening there. Because, from what I see, it's going to be a lot better than last year. And that will justify the valuation and, growth. Same with XPF. I think people will look back on this and think, that was cheap back then. I should have got in then. So, but we don't see that in the bear markets, do we? We just see the doom and gloom, So just got to sit tight.
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple of other stocks just to sort of like highlight to investors. I mean, they've got really, really strong tailwinds and will be growing rapidly over the next few years, despite the sort of sell-off and the thoughts about all recession and the market sort of having a real problem. First one, I mean, you've got Source Bio International, and I spoke to exec chairman Jay LeCue. And their sort of core business has got three sort of like legs to it. The key one, which is absolutely flying, is the cellular pathology division. And what you've got here is you've got the elective procedures all starting to come back, which is diagnosing things like, all kinds of conditions like cancer, et cetera, and biopsies. And these guys do it for the NHS, and they're seeing unprecedented demand coming from the NHS and also from sort of like, private health operators, but mainly from the sort of the NHS. There's a shortage of pathologists in the UK. They have the sort of like, one of the largest number as a third party operator. And they're overlaying that with all the digital technology from their LD Path acquisition at the start of the year. And this business is absolutely sort of flying. I think it's growing at about sort of like, you know, 30-40% per annum. So that's the sort of the biggest part of it and doing really, really well. And I could see that one going for years and years. I mean, the latest information coming out for elective procedures, there's still a waiting list of about 6.5 million, I think, patients who are on there. So there's a huge amount of people that the NHS need to work through, and they've got less resource to be able to do it, and they need to do it with tighter budgets. So that division for Source Bio is doing really well. And that's first. And then the other two divisions are right bang on track. You've got a genomics business that has just introduced a sort of like personalised medicine, precision medicine to help people, as I say, when it comes down to things like, you know, we've talked about sort of kidney transplants, to be able to get the right treatment for me as an individual, what my immune system's doing and all that kind of stuff. Genomics are going to be able to help that, and that's what they do with next generation sequencing, etc. So they offer that to NHS, which again is doing really well. And then they've got a more stable business that again is bang on track, is the stability storage operation that allows drug companies to store their particular products in there and look at how those affected over a long period in terms of different environments, etc. So that core business is doing really, really well. And then they've still got 15 million of cash, which was built up even after the acquisition, 15 million of sort of like, you know, net cash that came from their PCR COVID testing business. And then that's basically all that resource and people is being redeployed into their genomics and also into their cellular path pathology business. So they're just reutilizing the whole of the system. And I could see these shares easily sort of over £2 in the next couple of years. And I think looking at Liberum's, I think it's the house broker, they've got a £2.10. So, you know, I mean, it's a good quality business that with long-term secular growth drivers of demographics, healthcare, outsourcing, and really, really good, neat technology with operating leverage and obviously that digital telemedicine operation on top of it that's going to allow you to put things like AI on top, as well as obviously all that big data mining. I can only see this one going up in the long term. Again, you just got to be patient, but it's a high quality business. And interestingly enough, I mean, Jay LeCue, he owns about 3% of the company, and he bought another 100,000 shares just straight after the results at about 129. So, he's already got a big stake and he's putting more skin in the game, which just says everything.
Well, that's it. Talking about tailwinds like that, the NHS lists and all that queuing lists. And in fact, I was talking about that podcast I do with John Heumann, you know, screeners. The first screener we did was a Zulu screener, you know, small cat companies like the cats. Yeah, with good PEG ratios. Have you ever heard of Medica?
And Medica. 20
stocks there, and I went through a few of them.
They do telemedicine, don't they?
Yeah, well, telemedicine, basically.
For radiologists.
Yeah, radiology, MRI scans, all that sort of remotely. And of course, there's huge tailwinds there. And they're saying now that the government's under pressure to get these lists down, and this helps so much because, you know, the interpretation of all these MRI scans doesn't have to be done in hospitals. They're not taking up any space in the hospital. So they're pushing forward that. And just looking at what I think they're. EV is 189 million there. They generated 10 million in cash in 12 months to December, but three times sales per month. But they're actually doing really well. I mean, the growth there, 68% top line, operating profit up 141% to 12 million. And they said there's just more to come, you know, because they're trying to get more, some specialists on their books to help them get through the backlog. And I'm just thinking something like that's going to do well for years. Because let's be honest, the waiting list of the NHS is not going down for a long time, you know. And I suppose Totally as well is in that space where they'll benefit from those tailwinds, you know.
Yeah, no, I think the healthcare secretary, I mean, didn't he say that the actual waiting list, if anything, are going up above 10 million?
We're
furiously trying to get the things down.
Yeah.
Just because of the pandemic, there's a lot of people who haven't even been diagnosed yet, which is all coming back on. Because you've had 2 years of really sort of like slow upticks, both of operations and of people being, you know, having their treatments and diagnosis. So, anything in healthcare that's got exposure or a large position in sorting out elective procedures. It's just got a mountain of work coming down.
You've got good metrics as well, like 20% operating margin, and they're going to be paying dividend, they pay dividends as well. So something like that is very good. You know, it's a bit bigger than I look at, but I just like that. Mm. I mean, if you read the financial reports and updates, you can see everything's going their way. It's getting busier and busier, and literally they can't get enough staff to keep up with the work. So yeah, it's good. I like that. MGP.
Yeah, another one which has got huge tailwinds that again the market just got wrong this week is Manolet. I mean, I interviewed the CEO Stephen Cooklin yesterday, and I mean, just to give you a recap, these guys are the UK's largest specialist insolvency litigation firm. And what they do basically is take on legal cases, insolvency cases from insolvency practitioners. They buy them and then process them and return money to the creditors and solve all that problem. And they've just got an enormous sort of like, you know, again, mountain, Himalayan mountain heading down the track, because you've got three huge growth drivers. First and foremost is because of the government's unprecedented COVID creditor protection measures in that 2 years, it artificially suppressed the level of insolvencies coming through the courts and just the processing. You know, it banned a lot of, you know, you couldn't even take them to court. So it pushed all those insolvencies artificially down by about 40%. So you've got a huge backlog, like elective procedures, that's going to be worked through for years, okay? So that's the first one. If we do, and we are, getting into sort of like a tougher economic climate, you're going to see a hell of a lot more insolvencies than you'd seen before the pandemic, okay? And we are already starting to see that in terms of the stats, the government stats, the number of insolvencies are well above already the level they were pre-COVID. And that you've got retail, you've got construction companies in there, anything that is basically leveraged and they can't turn, you know, basically can't roll over their bank debt, etc. So you've got all of that. Plus, you've obviously got a lot of companies that actually were pretty edgy when it came to sort of like taking a lot of government loans, like, you know, basically the C-bills and also the bounce back loans and all these kind of stuff that frankly took them just to survive. And never had any sort of like, you know, motivation to pay it back. And so you've got potential director malfeasance going off. And these guys are real specialists to be able to recover that for the likes of HMRC and for the likes of the banks who were basically, you know, told to distribute these, particularly on the bounce back loan. So, you know, you've got those two huge tailwinds. You've got your backlog from your COVID. You've got more, obviously, you know, the insolvencies coming through simply because they've got to pay back these, you know, a lot of the loans and support, and there's tougher economic costs. And the third and final one is a secular one, not even a counter-cyclical one. And that's because they changed the law back in 2015 to allow insolvency practitioners to sell these cases to specialists like Manolet. And there has been a huge shift over that period since 2015-16 for insolvency practitioners to pass that through. But there still is, it's less than the, you know, there's still more being done by the insolvency practitioners than by these specialists by handling it. And so that secular trend will continue. So these guys have got three massive tailwinds for the next multi years. And yesterday, what was really interesting there, it came out with the results. And I looked at it and thought, right, great, you know, the in-line results, but the outlook is really positive. The broker came out with moving from a buy to a hold recommendation. And I just, the modest sort of like, you know, price target, and I just look at they got it totally wrong. Mm. And, you know, you've got to look at the future, you value this company on the future. And so even though the broker came out with a negative rating and a downgrade, essentially, the shares didn't move. The shares, there's canny investors who can see further than their nose and are looking at more optimistic. And again, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, the shares are currently just south. Well, I saw yesterday were just south of £3. What they are today, they're 2.92. And this will be well above £4, you know, in the next couple of years, yeah, simply because of those tailwinds.
Yeah, that is crazy, isn't it? Because you've got to look at that. I mean, of course, those are results. Maybe people are sold and not seeing it. Those results are from a year when they couldn't perform all the business they were given because it was shut down.
Yeah.
Now you've got that. And add on the recession coming. That's, you know, it's like one of those.
And the secular shift, shift of the whole industry to outsourcing, essentially, third party handling of these cases.
Yeah. Well, it's like, do you know what? Have you ever been to, when your girls were kids and you go to a water park and they have one of those buckets at the top filling with water?
Oh, yeah, I love them.
It's almost like in 2021, that pipe was shut down a little bit, like 50%. And then now it's been shut on, they've had another pipe again. It's going to topple over. It's going to be a load of water coming down the thing. So, yeah, it's odd that the broker's gone that way. I don't understand that, you know. But listen, we know brokers don't get it right a lot of the time.
I mean, you know. I think that's what investors need to look at. I mean, they've got to make your own decision. Don't be swayed by, you know, you take up a lot of information. You know, there's a lot of good information from brokers,
exactly.
No doubt about it. But essentially, the end result does come to somebody's opinion. And what I found, and the same thing is with Northbridge as much as anything, a lot of brokers just put a sort of like a, they do a, effectively, you know, they do a, they put their model onto a company and look at it through a lens that is old, and, you know, they don't really sort of like think about it. They just lift and shift an old model onto an existing company and they just just process it and turn the wheel without properly really understanding all the dynamics. Now, I'm not saying that's happening here because, you know, I don't pretend to be the, you know, sort of like the font of all knowledge. But I would say it's peculiar, absolutely peculiar. They came out, given the really positive tailwinds for this industry. And yes, they may well, you know, it'll take some time for it to feed through. The numbers are just starting to increase. So Q1 isn't likely to be electric, but sorry, Q1 isn't likely to be, you know, really stunner, but you'll probably see by the second half a real uptick in performance, and that will, but the share price will have already moved by then, simply because people will then say, well, actually, second half is good, means next year is going to be even better, and the following year, and it is. I mean, that's why they're ramping up the number of people they've got, and they've got a lot of, you know, funding capacity as well. So
sometimes it's hard when if you're looking for best in class, it's always good to sort of you know, measure it against peers to a certain extent on valuations. But if you realize it's better than peers, then you may give it the benefit of the doubt. But like I said, just be conservative sometimes and do it on a peer level valuation, and then you're sort of okay. But in fact, I know, talking about that, I think Trufin, for example, you know, you can value it on a peer level and it's fine, but I think it's way above peers. I mean, this is a globally significant software company and you know, advertising tech gaming company with hits on their hands, signing global partnerships. I think that's way above peers. But if you value it on peers, you know, it's not expensive. And in fact, tellingly, it's hardly gone down Trufin in the share price in this sell-off. So I'm hoping if it can hold its own in this kind of market, when we get some decent news out about developments, it'll really start to shift, you know. But but as I said, always look for, you know, I keep thinking that when I talk to you, actually, always look for best in class. Because, you know, why would you got money to invest? Why invest in anything less than best in class? But be careful of confirmation bias and all that kind of stuff. You've got to say, is it, you know, best in class, or am I just saying this because my money's invested in it? But it's always a tricky thing. Anything else we want to talk about?
Well, yeah, I mean, so coming full circle, you came into this conversation pretty sort of like, you know, negative. Damn, that now we've come through it the last hour. Are you a bit more positive?
No, but do you know what? Part of me thinks it's better being, I'm always going to be positive because I'm a long investor. You know, I don't short anything. I don't do anything like that. I don't have much cash on the sidelines. So I'm always going to be positive. Otherwise, I'd pull it all out pretty much. But I've got to be realistic and thinking, if you just look at the stats of the last bear markets, we aren't there yet. I'm not saying it's going to be worse. I'm saying that we've sold off pretty quickly. So maybe the rebound will be quicker because that can tend to happen, you know. Maybe we've been too pessimistic. And these days, with the we are in a new era where the media is so fast. You know, if you get some negative news out, it's around the world within seconds. So everyone says, "Oh, sell!" So maybe it reacts quicker. You know, who knows? It's like, you know, 2020 Dash for crash. That was the fastest sell-off ever, and the fastest rebound ever. I mean, are we seeing that now, that the negative news gets priced in so quickly that the rebound may happen a bit quicker? You know.
Anyway, keep them peeled. Watch out for those babies. Babies that we can talk about next time.
Marvellous stuff. Cheers, Paul. Speak next
time. Cheers, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.